This is Rafflebix After Hours.
Welcome, everybody, and your ears. It's Rack Addicts After Hours time, episode 87 from Rack Addicts Towers today. It's just a Pete and Ben for you this week. And if I may, I've got a couple of nuggets of update. The first update in my weekly update that I shall update you on is on that tactility thing, the satisfying objects thing, thematically linked with my second update. But I'm holding in my hands the Bikepacking Journal number 6. I think I mentioned bikepacking before, a previous episode, a way back. It's cycling and backpacking. You just camp. You bring camping stuff on a bike, which I have yet to do. I have aspirations, and not the money to buy the tent and such. But bikepacking.com is a great website with resources, routes, recipes, gear rundowns, that kind of stuff. But they have a print magazine as well, and it's glorious. A lot of the kind of people that do ultra endurance races, and I'm going to show Pete a picture here.
Oh, where's that?
I've no idea. What are we looking at? America. That's very specific. The Americas, even less specific. But a lot of the people that do this kind of stuff are also keen photographers, so we've got some excellent landscape shots.
I think that looks like South America.
A lot of them are. There's quite a lot of good epic trips there. But this print magazine with some great photography and really well-written stories. I've only just finished chewing through all of them. But it's really great. And not to sound rude, they're not especially memorable in and of themselves, each story, which means it's thoroughly rereadable and it's quite an absorbing, relaxing thing. I'm very pleased to have it. It's only a biannual thing. Biannual in the twice a year, not the once every two.
Is it expensive? It looks expensive.
It looks expensive.
It's more of a tome than a magazine, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's all wrapped up in the membership of the website, which I think is $60 a year. So that you could call that, it's $30 a magazine shipped. There's freebies and stickers and things. But it gives you discount codes and things and enters you into giveaways, and I'm about supporting them. So I don't mind that it could be a $30 magazine.
Well, it kind of looks like a $30 magazine.
Yep, it feels like it, which is why it's
so how many,
in that list.
What's that, a couple of hundred pages? Maybe not that
150, many. 160.
Oh, yeah. It's up there, isn't it? It's quite a...
It falls into that feel because...
It almost looks more like a coffee table book.
It's halfway between. It's wonderful, and I'm very pleased, and I can't wait to have an artfully arranged...
Selection.
Pile. It looks like maybe, was it casually thrown there after being read on the coffee table? Anyway, really enjoying it, and I do recommend the website. I must also update you on general cycly bikely things. That's the name of my WhatsApp chat with my friends about cycling. Anyway, we've been familiar with the synthesizer supply chain issues. They're even worse in the cycling world, I think. They were pretty bad with some synthesizery bits, or at least musical instruments. For example, the Roland pianos, we are familiar with telling customers, you're not getting one this year or probably next year. But yeah, cycling's been awful. Trying to find any specific component, if you want a specific bike frame, stuff like that, chances are you're not going to find it anywhere. It's been a nightmare. I know, at least I think Shimano is opening a new factory. They haven't really closed anything. They've just been absolutely flat out at capacity. I haven't been on the receiving end of supply chain woes, thankfully, but I think it has, well, it potentially has caused something that confuses me a little bit. So I'd appreciate your thoughts on this puzzle. I've seen a lot of people just going out for what looks like it's a weekend nice bike ride with the family or friends or something on Bromptons, or one thing I've seen, which was a folding electric fat bike. I'm wondering if the supply chain issues have forced people who are, oh yeah, I might buy a new bike, might get an e-bike. I wonder if the supply chain issues have forced that kind of person into choosing a strange, left-field, weird, probably more expensive bike just because that's what they could get hold of at the time. Because you wouldn't want to do a bike tour on a Brompton.
No, I mean, it's all about convenience in the respect of folding and transporting.
Yeah, they're for commuters, and they're some of the best.
Yeah, I mean, they're, they're exceedingly expensive bicycle.
But yeah, they're everywhere. I'm wondering if it's just because of the general shortage.
What do you think? Maybe the tons of commuters that have been doing weekend rides. Or as you say, people have just grabbed whatever was available. And a lot of the more conventional bikes have all been snapped up. I mean, certainly in 2020, bikes were few and far between. It
was still very hard to come by, a lot of them. Yeah, it might be a combination of everything, what is available. But yeah, maybe existing commuters had to find something to do on the weekends for their exercise. Early lockdowns when we had limited options, they thought, oh, I've got a bike, I'll go for a pedal.
I have literally not climbed onto a push bike or a cycle, I should say, in 3, maybe 4 years, even though I've got several of them.
Could be worse.
I have been considering getting an electric or pedal assist bike. It's quite a big purchase, but I was being slightly perturbed by the lack of choice and availability.
Yeah, unfortunately, the good ones are quite expensive. My mum is looking to buy one, and she sent me a link, and it just looked awful. For a start, it was stocked in Halfords, which was already probably a warning sign, a brand I hadn't heard of. That was about 1,100. I don't think they really get good until over
2,000, yeah. My friend has got a KTM, and he did get it reasonably inexpensive. Well, motorcycles. Is
yes.
Things, motocross, that type of thing. And he got it for around 1,800, and that was a particularly good price. But the same model now is roughly retailing at £2,500.
Lots of inflation there. Oh, yeah, they look... they look like good bikes rather than the ones where they have the hub motor and a battery just tacked onto a rear rack.
He is just getting up to 17,000 miles on it.
Wow.
Over, I wouldn't say, 3 years.
That's really good. Only just approaching 1,000 in 6 months.
Remember, those hills are nothing to him.
Of course, yeah.
I mean,
vertical walls.
We're talking about a gentleman who has had a replacement knee and a replacement hip.
Well, it's great that it can enable him to not suffer when he wants to go out on a ride.
Yes, I mean, he can glean the exercise he requires without walking. Walking's a problem, but cycling's okay. But with having the false joints, pedaling uphill, which is quite a strenuous sort of raising yourself out the saddle thing that you have to do, especially on really steep hills, is not a possibility. So having in general, I think one of the most common motors is a Bosch motor.
They do some good stuff.
Yamaha also do motors for them as well. But I noticed that a majority that I've seen anyway had Bosch motors, and they're quite powerful for what they are.
They're pretty juicy, yeah.
I think his range is quite good. I think the range is between 50 and 70 miles on one charge.
It is really good, yeah. I think the really high-end ones tend to be the bottom bracket mounted motors, but actually the hub motors are still really good.
Okay, well, this is a bottom bracket mounted motor, but the really expensive ones are the top downhiller type.
Yeah, definitely. I'm looking at one here from Orbea. Talking 6,800.
Yeah, I reckon that's the sort of price, 5,000 to 10,000.
Definitely. I mean, you know, full carbon, top of the range road bikes can go for 12, which is ridiculous. Anyway, another quick chunk on the cycling front. I went on a group gravel ride, which is just 90s mountain bikes and going on light cross country trails. It was good fun, but it was sort of with a club associated with a shop. In the southeast, you can probably figure out what it is. It was, yeah, strange. So I knew a few people there already from the sort of the Londonish group, which was nice. But, you know, being surrounded in full, you know, the heart of Mammil territory. If you don't know what Mammil stands for, it's middle-aged man in Lycra. So it was, yeah, it was a strange place. And I'll admit, I do have the proper cycling shorts. And it is Lycra, but I have the modesty and I wear shorts over the top, so I don't scar people for life.
I didn't realise they go for the full Lycra when they're doing the mountain biking bit. I thought they went for the more street cred type of clothing, the more sort of hipstery, skateboardy type stuff.
So mountain bikers, cross country, downhill, any of those sub-disciplines would definitely do that and call them the baggies.
Yeah.
Road bike, obviously completely the opposite. And then the weird gravel phenomenon is strangely in between. So you'll get the full Lycras. You'll get sort of the me in the middle, which is, yeah, I've got the kit, sort of the Lycra, but then I'll either wear just a normal sports shirt or and I will have my light shorts over the top. And you also get the rather weird combination of bib shorts, which are cycling shorts with the kind of dungaree-ish support bit, so you don't have weird waistband issues.
I think they're even weirder, especially if
that's what everyone is wearing.
You're sporting
underneath
a little bit of a belly.
Yep, you get that lovely little kind of cut.
The sort of, what was it, the muffin top?
Yeah, but imagine that, and then a Hawaiian shirt over the top. It's really odd.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a strange sight.
Sort of rocking a sort of MASH theme going on there.
Yeah, I don't know what it was, but it was partly unpleasant, partly comical, and just generally very uncomfortable. But the ride did end at a brewery, so I was happy.
I get the gist. It wasn't as horrendous as your previous ride you described to us the other week.
No, this was much more fun. About half the length, and there was beer. And it wasn't raining. It was dry.
No slippery chalk.
No slippery chalk to be found. Barely even a puddle this time. It was great.
Oh, brilliant.
Anyway, that will conclude my cycling ramble. Pete, what have you been up to this week?
Well, a couple of things. Just briefly, I wanted to let you know that I have ordered the Queen of Pentacles.
Oh, yes.
The Endorphins.
Drum machine, some samples, some analogue.
Yeah, so you've
vaguely
got
909.
Three sort of 909 voices, a kick, a snare, and I can't think what the other one is. And then you've got four sample slots. It comes with pre-sampled samples.
Pre-sampled samples.
It comes with samples, and there's a selection, and you can obviously replace those with anything else you like. But until I get my hands on it. But so that's winging its way to me at some point this week. I'm hoping it will arrive tomorrow, but knowing the way things can be,
we'll
it may
see.
Be the following day, but it is on its way. And I most probably will order the Qubit Surface before the end of the week.
Oh, the physical modelling.
Yes.
I didn't know that was on the cards.
Yes, I'm going to use that to replace the rings. I just think it's got more to it. Rings has
certainly
really
does.
Only got the
three. Yeah, there's three, and I remember basically using one sound on it all the time.
Got the sort of bell, the kind of pluck, and then the more percussive sort of
sound. I think it's supposed to be sort of a wooden stick type, like a clave sort of thing.
But I believe the Surface has got maybe 10?
Yeah, it's got loads more stuff going on, and it's pretty cool.
Yeah, so that's going to happen, and then at some point I'm going to be ordering a Monsoon to replace the Clouds.
Oh yeah, of course, expanded DIY type.
And
yes,
also smaller than the Clouds. What I'm wrestling for at the moment is more rack space. That's why...
You're getting into that shuffly stage.
Yes, because I've got a fixed size and I can't keep it ever expanding it. Now I'm sort of fixed on the two rows of 104 HP. I've really got to juggle it around. I have got a modular grids configuration and it's all locked. I've actually flicked the button that actually freezes it.
That's brave.
I think I'm quite happy with it. There's just, other than the Surface and the Monsoon, all I've got to get after that is something to sequence the drums.
I was
going to
ask. Yeah, what have you got something penciled in?
At the moment, all I'm thinking about is one of those dots.
DNI Pro.
You can only get from the manufacturer at the moment. I'm not sure if they've even got stock. Everywhere else says that it's due in at some point, but they don't seem to have a date. And they are from, I want to say, somewhere in Eastern Europe. So I'm not sure what their production schedule is like. What size if it's a one-man, two-man band, then it could be quite slow or quite a long time before I'm able to get my hands on one of those. I've only got a very few modules to get now, and the rack will be complete. So hopefully there still might be some editing going on. Some modules might leave, some other modules might join in. It's a work in progress.
Since we're on the DNI Pro train, I will quickly shove in a small news nugget. Don't know too much about it, but it did catch my eye just visually. They have a new module called Crate, K-R-A-I-T, which is a three-channel knob recorder, LFO and random generator for 8-bar loops of manually inputable, loopable CV for complex modulations, tap tempo LFOs, random type stuff, but designed to be nicely sequenced and loop with your patterns. But it has a really cool LCD, which is just a really thin vertical one, which shows sort of a waveform. And it's really pretty, so I'd definitely have a look at the videos because it's a really nice-looking, quite compact thing if you need a CV knob recorder. DNI Pro Modular Crate.
Right. The other thing that I was going to tell you about was my trip to London for my field recording.
Yes, please do.
So, Yes, London.
Mm. Now, I naively... Have you been to London since the great unlockening?
This was my first visit to London in possibly 3 years.
Wow, that is a while. Yeah.
Yeah. So I naively expected it to be relatively quiet throughout the pandemic, throughout all the lockdowns. All I've heard about is London's like a ghost town.
It has been a couple of times when I was there.
With all the travel restrictions and all the countries that we're not allowed to travel to for various reasons, and I would imagine in some respects that works in reverse as well, mm-hmm. I thought the place would be devoid of tourists.
Yes.
Wasn't like that at all. It was more crowded than I've ever seen it.
Really?
It was absolutely packed. Myself and my friend who accompanied me for this recording outing walked from Waterloo to the south bank of the Thames near where the London Eye, which is the large Ferris wheel, if anyone's not from the UK, but it might be familiar with London. And the embankment, which is quite a large promenade for pedestrians.
Fairly wide.
So crowded, it was almost claustrophobic.
Ooh, that's really gross.
Yes, it was really quite intense. And there was a lot of activities, a lot of street artists and performers.
On the plus
performers.
Side, probably some good street ambience.
There were some interesting sounds, but initially we were so taken aback. We had taken N95 face masks, so we were fully masked even outside in those parts.
That was definitely a good call.
So we managed to catch audio, as I said before, in Waterloo Station on the London Underground and in the streets. In fact, basically, I just ran the recorder
the whole way.
Virtually the whole way. I did switch it off on occasions, but I got snapshots, decent snapshots, all the way through to the British Museum, which is the large museum in London, which is centred around archaeological relics.
Yeah.
And I also took one of my Canon camera bodies and some large lenses, so captured a lot of visuals as well.
Nice.
But mainly I was there for the audio.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a reasonable success in the respect that we didn't talk all over it when we were recording, but the sounds weren't the same. So something like the concourse at Waterloo Station, it had the reverb, but the announcements weren't of good quality.
Right. When did you do the last one?
We did the last one, I want to say, in 2017.
Right.
I've always thought that we've got to a stage where the announcements were pre-recorded, but I suppose they can't be because they have to deal with cancellations and changes to the schedule.
Mm.
So the PA wasn't turned up as much as I'd hoped it had been, and the particular announcer, which was a lady, there was nothing particularly wrong with her voice, but the volume was quite low, so it was really difficult to get the clarity that I was looking for. When I'd been there previously, it was a male voice and it was much louder, much clearer, and it resonated a lot more.
Mm.
There's a lot of good stuff in there, and I've now got to go through the tedious task of extricating the good bits.
But, definitely, I always put that off.
But I have a sample here for everyone's delectation.
Ooh,
so we
wonderful.
Can think, just a very brief one. So this is from the London Underground.
Nice one. I was there. There's only a few lines that have the old mind the gap still.
I think it's some of the older platforms, especially ones that are on very sharp bends. Because depending on the camber of the bend, it makes the train lean away from the platform. But some of the really newer underground workings, the edge of the platform meets with the edge of the door much better.
Yeah, no, it totally reminds me of certain trips to London rather than others because you don't often meet it.
Well, that was on the Northern Line, which I believe is one of the oldest lines in London. So Victorian, I would want to say, originally.
Potentially. I'm not very good with my London Underground history. There is a YouTube channel for that, if you're interested.
Of course. Well, several, actually.
Yeah, plenty.
But yeah, I mean, it's certainly one of the very old lines.
That sounded great.
Yeah, I've got plenty of that, and the lots of reverby areas and lots of sort of muffled noises and speech and various bits and pieces.
How was the fabled hall, not hallway, the atrium in the museum?
That was quite good, and I've got another section which was a bit long for our purposes today to play to the public, a bit more subtle.
Yeah.
As I say, it's mostly the sheer ambience, which you can hear the reverb. It's the whole thing is just reverberating, and then there's occasional sort of squeaks and noises, especially good at young children because they tend to be sort of squeaking, so they produce these high-pitched noises. But in that much reverb, they sound almost ethereal.
Nice one. Looking forward to it. So this is destined for a radio music and a synthesizer performance near me.
Yes.
Excellent. If not the September ModCaf, because actually not got too long, maybe the October, which we might actually be back in the Westie at that point.
Well, that'd be great.
We'll see.
Well, we're getting close. As I say, we still have not got a functional case. We've got all these modules, and that is the big barrier. And I keep telling myself, this week I shall set to and start constructing it, and then I just end up staring at YouTube.
It's always the way. I'm actually making all right progress this week on ditching the YouTube addiction. I think it is a bit of an addiction, but it is going slowly.
Yeah, I've definitely got a YouTube habit. It's a bit of a problem, but I'm prepared to talk about it.
I think I might need to talk about it at some point. Anyway, let's jump into synthesizer news. I've already burnt one of those cards, but I'll quickly do a small, very small nugget before we jump onto that juicy one that, this turned up yesterday, I think. But anyway, five episodes ago, maybe, I'm really bad at guessing these things, I mentioned that the Rhodes Group has appeared and will be producing pianos once more. Not really that much news from them, but I have discovered a few things. They've been doing R&D in England with apparently a star-studded cast of experts and users and enthusiasts. It's in Leeds, as far as I know. So UK-made might make it a little bit cheaper for us, potentially. I'm not going to hold up too much hope. But there's a quote here which is quite interesting. I don't know. Oh, yes, I can find out who that was. This is Dan Goldman, who's the chief product officer and longtime Rhodes fan and player. This is on the new Rhodes piano. Compared to the old pianos, it's got all the vibe and soul, but everything that wasn't precisely built has been precisely built and with massive detail. I think it's the ultimate collision of the vintage world and the modern world. I think what we've achieved in the last 2 years is going to blow people's minds.
And their wallets, most probably.
Short. Absolutely, wallets. There is a photo. I don't know, given how photorealistic renders can be these days. There's a couple of in-production shots which have people in them, so maybe these are real. But we've got a picture of the front right-hand corner. You can see a little Rhodes-branded, bumpery, rubber corner piece thing. Tolex wrapped. I'm confident that they're not, at least in all of the models, going to be shelling out for the full fiberglass kind of construction like I think Vintage Vibe do. So I think they're not cutting corners, but they're making decisions so that it won't be completely astronomical. Given that they have competition in the form of Vintage Vibe, I think they could potentially be trying to have a slightly lower budget option. Don't quote me on that, and it still won't be cheap. Anyway, it's sequential time. Pete, do you want to take me through it? Because I completely ignored it, despite coming across the headline.
Okay, well, Sequential have announced a new synth. And in some respects, it's quite radically different in the form factor, for starters, although it is the chassis that was previously used for the Pro 3.
I was going to say, on first glance, I could totally just go, yeah, Pro 3, whatever.
Yeah, so I would imagine they've done it in this respect to cut the cost. The thing that makes it somewhat unique, and we can get into the features a bit later on, is the price.
Oh, have we got numbers?
Yes. So UK retail price is going to be $1,099.
Oh.
So that is dramatically cheap for a sequential polyphonic synth.
Yeah, it is. I assume five voice, give and take five.
One could assume that. It's not overly clear. It talks about...
Because that is kind of a weird number.
Yes. But five voices is a five-note polyphony is a bit of a weird number, isn't it? You would think it'd be six.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows? It doesn't scream about it in the documentation. It talks about the details of the functionality, but not quantities of polyphony.
So given that it is Pro 3 looking,
yeah,
do we know how much analog and digital?
Well, according to this, they describe the oscillators as VCOs.
Okay, that's good, because I hate the digitalness of the Pro 3.
Yeah, but they don't, as I say, they don't describe them as DCOs. They're definitely VCOs.
Cool.
Plus sub-oscillator.
Cool.
Including hard sync and front panel FM. So what do they mean by front, the fact that you've got...
Oh, it's probably just on a knob ready to go rather than a menu.
Doesn't look like there's much in the way of menu diving anyway. It looks like everything is on the control surface.
Well, yeah, very small screen, which would be annoying. I mean, they're always small on sequential stuff anyway.
I think this potentially opens the door to a lot of people that possibly would have wanted a Prophet 6 or even a Rev 2 and thought it was slightly beyond their budget.
Or a bit thin and weedy sounding, which is normally my complaint. I'm skimming through an article while you're going. Four-pole analog filter that's based on the Prophet 5, apparently. Sounds good to me.
Well, there's no reason. We know our experiences of having to repair sequential equipment that when you open them up, there's virtually nothing inside. There's a main motherboard where all, and generally all the rear interfaces are mounted on the main motherboard.
Yep.
Then the voices are just like...
little RAM DIMM.
Yeah, like DIMMs in DIMM sockets.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got the circuit board that holds the control surface that's on the back, and then maybe a couple of flat ribbon cables, but virtually nothing.
Not
it's mostly fresh air inside there.
Fresh air to collect dust.
This is just the same. So, you know, I haven't really handled the Pro 3 that much, but it looks just a bit more plasticky.
Yeah, it doesn't feel bad plasticky, but it's not wooden end cheeks. Not that I care that much, but I'm sure it'll be nice and durable.
So I was wondering, do you think this is something that Dave Smith had up his sleeve, or do you think this has been promoted by Focusrite saying we need an entry-level synth at a budget?
That is a very good question. I don't know that there would really be, would there really be any way of telling just from what information they release and potentially how they end up marketing it. Okay, what's it competing with at about a grand for a, well, 8 or below voice?
So aren't we looking at things like, well, the trouble is all the things I'm thinking of are digital.
Prologue, 8.
Yeah.
That's 9 something.
Yeah.
It was last I checked.
What about the Hydra, which is just a bit above, but that's still reasonable.
Very different vibe.
Yeah. Yeah. Digital. That's what I'm saying. I'm thinking a lot of the synths at this price point are digital.
Yeah, that's true.
I can't think much that's analog.
So there'll be the mini logs, but we don't know the voice count yet. So.
I always consider the mini logs as being in the budget class.
They are, yes, about 500 or below.
And even something like the DeepMind 12, I still think it's in the budget sort of range. This is sort of not quite budget. It's up there. It's sort of north of 1,000.
I'm trying to picture the wall at work, but Novation Peak, but that's a module.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unless we're forgetting something obvious, then maybe it is kind of floating off in its own sort of pretty approachable point.
I think they could be onto a bit of a winner. If this thing sounds good, I think it will sell really well.
If it doesn't have any issues like some sequential synths have had. But no.
Yeah. Generally, they've resolved a lot of those problems. If there is any issues, they will resolve.
Yeah.
Instead of us having to deal directly with Dave Smith in the States and deal with all the time zone differences, now we're dealing with Focusrite, and there's a...
infinitely better.
UK channel. Well, there's nothing wrong with Dave Smith per se. It's just the time zone thing and being on a different continent isn't a great way of communicating with a supplier.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to check out this... Oh, actually, we've got a couple of videos. There's one by Inholt, which is a sound design demo. Maybe Inholt has done or is doing some presets for it. I don't know. Do you know Inholt?
I'm not personally familiar with that person.
Something I've come across before. And the other one is from Sequential's channel, so I'll have a listen to those later.
Yeah, so if this is a good sounding synth, it's a very good value proposition.
Definitely.
I don't know how long it takes to develop a synth, and I know that they will pull lumps of circuit from other models.
Oh, yeah.
So they'll combine things. So it's not as if they're having to design the whole thing from the ground up.
Reusing a chassis.
Yeah, they often talk about it. In fact, the way they mention the Prophet 5 filter, the Rev 4 filter.
Intriguing, because none of the sequential stuff has really screamed at me, mostly because of it being expensive or not juicy enough in the case of the Rev 2. But that's... keep an eye on it. and keep an eye on it. And hopefully, assuming you're still at the shop while it's available.
According to what I've read, it's currently available now, but whether that's exclusively in the US or everywhere.
Well, even if it is just the US, maybe that is something that Sequential just had ready to go.
Having said that, we don't know how long the Focusrite deal was in the offing.
That is true.
From what I read on the Sequential website, Dave Smith is no longer the CEO of the company. He is only solely responsible for technological development.
Okay, that is interesting. I know they were keeping him around because they should or something.
I mean, last year we celebrated his 70th birthday.
Yeah, and of course he's probably going to want to be in a position to ensure that it's in good hands.
I would imagine he just wants to indulge his passion, which is designing synths, and he doesn't really want to be bogged down with all the horrible day-to-day things of running
a
company.
Enjoy
synthesizers. I mean, as you say, this could have been something they had in the offing, or it could have been a nudge from Focusrite saying we need to hit this something in this price point.
Intriguing.
But on paper, it looks interesting.
Definitely, definitely.
So proof's going to be in the pudding when we hear it.
Indeed. Lovely stuff. Well, that takes us through the synthesizer news section of things and round to the end of episode 87, creeping closer to episode 90, and of course the big century not too far away. It's time for our miscellaneous multimedia recommendation, as always, the terribly named breathless reach for alliteration. I don't have one, actually, at the moment, because I've been trying to escape YouTube. I haven't been thinking about it. Pete, can you save me while I scramble around the internet for something?
Certainly. And as usual, this week is another YouTube channel.
You're just doing it on purpose, aren't you?
Yes. So this week, I have been enjoying re-watching various documentaries from my favourite science communicator, or one of my favourite science communicators, Professor Jim Alkalely from Surrey University.
Oh.
And he has made many documentaries focusing on topics surrounding physics. He's personally involved in research into quantum physics himself. His documentaries tend to have a historical slant to them, and I suppose that's the way you have to go with that type of information. You have to start at the point where science started evolving on that particular topic, generally from around the Enlightenment onwards, or certainly from about 300 years going forward. And I've been watching his documentaries on a channel called Spark, which hosts a variety of science-y type programming. And they're very informative, let's say. There is one particular documentary, and I would state it's most probably one of my top 10 documentaries.
Oh, yeah.
Unfortunately, it's not available on this particular channel, but it is one from Professor Alkalely. It is entitled The Secret Life of Chaos.
I think you might have recommended that one to me before.
Yes, and it was one of those documentaries where when I first saw it, I actually had an epiphany.
Oh, wow.
Because it explains chaos theory from its earliest roots in mathematics right up to the latest research, let's say, although most of the concepts and ideas are pretty much set and have been for some time. But it goes quite a long way to explain how complex matter, including life, can form out of literally nothing, just out from energy. And it is explained in a way that is entirely graspable. And as I say, I watched it and literally had an epiphany.
Wow, that's always the good bit about, it's what shows a great documentary is actually being able to bring some pretty radical concepts into the grasp of mere mortals who are actually kicking back on the sofa and don't want to engage the brain too much.
Yes, certainly. On the audio side, there's generally good music with these documentaries. It's particularly well chosen, so it can be anything from avant-garde ambient stuff, quite current, or Debussy and Eric Satie and that type of stuff. The ambient music of the 100 years ago, let's say.
Nice.
But yeah, so the channel is simply called Spark. It hosts a variety of other science documentaries and programming, but particularly look out for the documentaries by Jim Alkalely. The ones I've watched so far, there was one on energy. It was explaining the science of energy from the mathematical theorems onwards. And then he goes into, there's one on the atom and he does one on gravity. So he picks these very sort of what seemingly sound like very narrow topics, but they expand out enormously and end up literally growing to universal scales.
Nice one. If you're curious about how we all got started, then it seems like there's a couple out there.
Yes, certainly.
Wonderful. The ModCaf has saved me from the depths of trying to find stuff in my bookmarks. Graham has actually posted recently with quite a good one. He asked a question: what was your first synth and have you still got it? Listeners, please reach out to us at Rackaddicts UK on Facebook and Instagram. Please tell us, what was your first synth and have you still got it? Well, Graham has got a bit of a dealio for himself. His first ever synth was a Yamaha CS-01. And he's been looking out for them for ages, but they're either tatty or overpriced. He's got a good one with bag, with original box, and apparently it's an easy MIDI retrofit too. Do you know the CS-01?
No. Is it a synth that he originally had a long time ago and he's reacquiring one?
Indeed, that's very much the way. So, analog mono synth, according to Vintage Synth Explorer, you've probably seen it around before. Speaker top right, sliders, and in the bottom left, you've got some dials, which are kind of recessed into the thing. You might be familiar with that chassis there. So, it was designed as quite a few were. I think there are a few from Casio around about the same time, which were, you know, beginners, in inverted commas, beginner synthesizers. So, not too much control, not too much complexity, but they ended up having kind of underground fans. Apparently it's got some really good bass and things, but I hope Graham is enjoying his CS-01 once more. But listeners, let us know what your favourite old synth was. Pete, what was your first synth?
My first synth, it was a bit of a coincidence, was a Yamaha CS-30.
Ah, nice one. I'm going to have to quickly look at what was
check
the
CS-30
it out. Like?
To be honest, it was the opposite to that one that you've just shown me.
The opposite? Oh, the start of the description on Vintage Synth Explorer says, large, knob-infested. And yeah, that is a beast.
Yeah, my gas problem started early.
Gotcha.
And that was in 1979, I want to say.
Nice one. It certainly looks pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's got a proper step sequencer. I mean, it's got everything.
Nice.
I have been considering acquiring one again just for novelty value. Most probably would be sorely disappointed after all these years, but the only source I've found is being actually in Japan.
Being able to find one.
Yes. So they're not too expensive when they come up, but, you know, we're talking no MIDI, obviously.
Gotcha.
I suspect there must be some sort of way of clocking it externally.
Might be able to. Had a quick eBay for you. Got a couple at $2,000.
Yep, they're not cheap. It wasn't cheap when I got it. It was quite an expensive synth at the time. But I traded that in.
Anything good?
I maybe that one there.
Oh, the Lambda?
Yeah, the Korg Lambda.
Nice.
But I bought a bunch altogether. So about the same time I bought the Jupiter 4, the Korg Lambda, and an SH-101.
You've had some good stuff, haven't you?
All around the sort of between 1980 and 1982, I got that lot. So I can't remember. But most probably the Jupiter 4 first. So that most probably was the one that came after the CS-80.
Nice. For comparison, my experience in the synthesizer world is laughably short. Started with the Korg Monologue fairly soon after release. When was that released? Why do I feel like it was 2018 when I started? I know, 2016.
Yeah, I was going to say about 5 years ago.
Yeah, I think I've only really been into synths for about 4 years, which shows my propensity for being interested in something, researching the hell out of it for quite a long time, jumping headfirst in and then being stuck with a bunch of random knowledge kicking about in my head and then not doing very well in exams at school. That's how it went. Always the way. Well, please do let us know where you started in the synthesizer world, assuming you are a synthesizer person. I believe a lot of you are. As always, thank you so much for listening, and we will catch you in episode 88. Farewell.